Thank you, Shahid, and good morning, everyone. And knowing that if we overrun, that will have an impact on the coffee break, we will do our best not to. I'm going to start with a brief reminder of some of the basic principles on candour, and then take a closer look at three key issues in respect of the defendant's duty. I'm then going to hand over to Charlotte, who will give us a case study, a recent high-profile case where things went somewhat awry. We've each produced a paper that's in your pack that has all the case references. I'm afraid we are not sufficiently technologically savvy to have produced slides, or at least I wasn't. But the papers start at page 51 of the pack. First of all, full and candid disclosure about me and my practice. I am on the government panel, but I also do cases for claimants, so I don't come at this topic from a particularly partisan perspective. The core idea of candour is that the parties to judicial review have a duty to assist the court by putting forward all relevant facts, and in the defendant's case, explaining the process that led to the decision being challenged and the reasons for that decision. And one can trace this core principle all the way back to the mid-80s case of Huddleston in the Court of Appeal. They said that this was based on the idea that the courts and defendant public authorities had, and I quote, a partnership based on a common aim, namely the maintenance of the highest standards of public administration. So the idea is that defendants should assist the court in reaching the right answer rather than being partisan in defending claims, particularly because they will often hold much of the information that's relevant in the case, and candor requires telling the whole truth, not just aspects that suit the defendant's own case. Now, people in this room who are at the coalface of public law litigation will have their own views about how many defendant public authorities think of themselves as being in a partnership with the courts. And it's fair to say that in recent years, there have been a number of high-profile cases where the courts have been critical of particular public authorities for lack of candour. Perhaps the most famous example is the Al Sweedy case. That was a human rights claim regarding treatment of Iraqi detainees by British forces, where the court identified significant and continuing disclosure failings. It stayed those proceedings and ordered the Secretary of State to pay the costs of the whole proceedings on an indemnity basis. And in the aftermath of that case, the Treasury Solicitor's Department, as it then was, published some very helpful guidance on what candour requires. It's intended as a guide for departments and case handlers, but there is much there of value for others, and it's not uncommon to see claimants relying on it when they're pressing for disclosure. The first of the topics I'd like to look at in a little bit of more detail is, when does the duty of candour actually kick in? Is it when the letter for action is received? Is it when you're drafting summary grounds? Or is it not until the stage where permission has been granted and you're drafting detailed grounds and evidence? And that's clearly an issue of some importance because many cases will fizzle out in the early stages. A robust reply to letter for action may result in a potential claimant not getting legal aid or simply deciding that the case is not worth pursuing. And if the defendant was holding back some key information that might have improved the claim, then that would be a matter of concern. On the other hand, a full-blown candour obligation at the pre-action stage might be viewed as too onerous on hard-pressed public authorities. Surprisingly, there's no particularly clear answer in the case law to the question. The TESOL guidance takes a very wide view. It says the duty applies as soon as the defendant is aware that someone is likely to challenge one of its decisions, and continues to apply at every stage of the proceedings thereafter. A slightly different view seemed to be taken in a discussion paper that was published back in 2016 by the Lord Chief Justice. It proposed that the practice direction to Part 54 should be amended to clarify what was said to be the minimum scope of the duty of candour, and the proposed rule would have said a defendant should, in its detailed grounds or evidence, identify any relevant facts and the reasoning underlying the measure in respect of which permission to apply for judicial review has been granted. Now, for now, there's been no amendment along those lines, and I think there would be a concern that if that was the rule, then defendants would not feel that they were required to comply with candor unless and until permission had been granted. It seems to me that the better view is that candor is required even before the permission stage has completed, but that the court's expectations of what is required will be somewhat less exacting at that stage. So candor will still require a defendant to avoid making any factually incorrect assertion or creating a misleading impression of the facts, but the defendant will not be required to give full chapter and verse on every aspect of the decision-making process pre-permission. And there's some support for that from the recent Terror Services case that is mentioned in the paper. This was a challenge to various decisions in connection with a search warrant that had been issued pursuant to a request by the US Department of Justice. They were seeking evidence for their investigation into links between the Russian government and Donald Trump's election campaign. The claimant, who was on the receiving end of the search warrant, argued that there should be a hearing to determine disclosure issues before permission had been decided. The divisional court accepted that the duty of candor can apply at or even before the permission stage, but on the facts, it was not persuaded that the court required more documents in order to resolve the permission application. My second topic is, does the duty of candor apply in relation to unpleaded grounds of challenge? So does the defendant have to reveal some features of the decision-making process which are not relevant to the grounds as currently framed by the claimant, but which could potentially be relied upon in support of additional grounds? Now, the Huddleston case that I mentioned earlier suggests not. The Court of Appeal was clear in that case that just because you've got permission, you can't expect the defendant to give a detailed account of every single step in the process in the hope that something will turn up to give you a valid ground of challenge. There's obviously a tension here between stopping fishing expeditions, that phrase that one sees repeatedly from judges, set against the fact that the claimant often just won't know the facts that might support that new ground that could prove the winner. Again, the TESOL guidance in this context is the claimant's friend, because it says that it's clear that the duty extends to documents or information that will assist the claimant's case and or give rise to additional and otherwise unknown grounds of challenge. The authority it cites for that proposition is an old case called Hook and Barnsley. You might remember this was the market trader who was seen by council employees answering a call of nature in a side street and didn't take too kindly to being told off by them. Lord Denning said in the report that he hadn't been told what exact words the claimant had used, but that he expected it was an emphatic version of "you be off." Well, the claimant's license was revoked after a hearing by the relevant council committee. The Court of Appeal heard there'd been a breach of natural justice because the market manager, who was effectively the prosecutor against the claimant, had been present with the committee during its deliberations. That fact had only emerged from the defendant's evidence, and it hadn't been pleaded as a ground of challenge by the claimant. But the Court of Appeal said, well, his claimant's grounds shouldn't be treated rigidly. If a new ground emerges from the defendant's evidence, then the court can inquire into it, even if it hadn't been pleaded at the outset. So it seems to me Hook actually deals with a slightly different situation where new grounds of challenge happen to emerge from the material served by the defendant. It's not directly addressing the separate point of whether the defendant was actually under a duty in the first place to reveal information that might be relied upon in support of an unpleaded ground. However, there are some indications in the case law in support of that proposition, including Lord Kerr in the recent Banker No. 4 case, approving a passage from Mike Fordham's famous book. But it seems to me that difficult issues can arise if we accept the point of principle about requiring defendants to reveal information relevant to unpleaded grounds. How strong does this putative unpleaded ground have to be before a defendant's under a duty to reveal information about it? Does the defendant have to provide information about a ground it considers to be entirely hopeless? Or would the defendant have to assess the ground as having some force, and if so, how much? And those are matters that are not addressed on the case law as it stands. It's worth just mentioning the converse scenario, where the claim as pleaded could be read as including wider grounds, but the defendant, for perhaps obvious reasons, tries to read it in a narrow way and to give candor disclosure on that narrow basis only. This happened in the recent MP case, also in the paper, which was a challenge to regulations on charging non-UK residents for NHS services. One of the issues was whether there was a legitimate expectation that changes to those regulations would be consulted on. The defendant read the claim as arguing that the expectation arose only from three specific past consultations and only disclosed information relating to those three. The court was satisfied that the claim had never been put on that narrow basis, and it wasn't satisfied that full disclosure had been given, and that led to the hearing being adjourned to enable further evidence to be provided. And Ms. Justice Lewis said that where a defendant chooses to read the claim in a limited way and limits the information it provides pursuant to candor accordingly, it should tell the court and the other parties what it's done, so that any issues about disclosure can be addressed before you get to your hearing. The last topic I'd like to touch on is, when does the defendant have to disclose documents? Candor is the reason why we don't have a general duty of disclosure in judicial review. The idea is that it would be unnecessary to have a duty of disclosure because candor will already have kicked in and the defendant will already have provided all the information. There are circumstances, however, where giving a factual account of the decision-making process is not enough and documents are also required. The recent Jet 2 case in the paper confirms that a claimant doesn't have to show that there's some substantial doubt about whether candor has been complied with in order to get an order for specific disclosure. The test remains that identified in the Tweed case. Is disclosure necessary for fairly and justly disposing of an issue? Now, it's always seemed to me that that's a somewhat Delphic test. When will it be necessary? When will it be necessary to achieve justice? And the answer is that it's still very much for a claimant to make the running here, to show that it's necessary, and it's possible probably to identify two main categories where you're likely to have a receptive court. The first is in human rights cases where there's an issue of proportionality and where the court's judgment is likely to involve getting into a careful examination of all the factual material said to justify an interference with human rights. Even there, disclosure won't be automatic, though. And the second is where, even in a judicial review, a hard-edged question of fact can arise, such as the sort of jurisdictional issues one sees in cases about children under the Children Act, is someone a child or not? And in that kind of case, the administrative court will be prepared to roll up its sleeves and get involved in some real fact-finding with documents required. With that brief canter, to use the word of the day, through the basic principles, I'm going to hand over to Charlotte to tell you all about a recent case.
So we've heard about the principles that apply across the board to the duty of candor. We have heard that the discussion started in 1986 in Huddleston, and that these principles have been addressed in a whole series of cases at all levels of the court system, from the Privy Council to the Supreme Court, to the House of Lords, and now the Supreme Court. And they were recently summarised, and it's a useful place to look, in a case called Hureau from 2018. It's a divisional court case. It's in the paper of mine. It's also referred to in Ian Steele's paper, which my paper is at page 51 of the bundle. Now, in that case, Lord Justice Singh emphasised that the reason why the ordinary rules of disclosure do not apply in judicial review is because there is a separate but no less onerous duty, which is, of course, the duty of candor and cooperation. and it falls on public authorities and not on other litigants. It's important to recognise that this duty has frequently been described as a high duty. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, a way out of Part 31 disclosure. It is in many ways a higher duty on public authorities to cooperate with the courts because of what you've heard from Ian Steele is the duty and the partnership between public authorities and the court. That is where the duty is rooted. And it should mean that public authorities want to tell the court the whole truth about what they've done and should be actively enthusiastically working with the court to examine whether their actions are lawful. Now, of course, we've heard that does not always happen, and we may not recognise that from our practices. But what the duty means is that public authorities are expected to assist the court with full and accurate explanations of all relevant facts and to cooperate with it by themselves drawing attention to defects in their case. And that ordinarily means witness statements, which will need to be produced explaining those relevant facts. And it also means that those who are responsible for drafting those witness statements must make sure that the statements do not obscure matters of central relevance, are ambiguous or economical with the truth. They must, in particular, not employ spin. And the way it was described in the case of Hureau, adopting language of Treasury Counsel in that case, was that those witness statements must include the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, importantly, on the question of what comes with those witness statements, or whether those witness statements should be produced at all, and that is an issue that some of us may have noticed arose in the Supreme Court case that we've heard about earlier today, Cherry and Miller, is that the duty is not complied with by offloading large amounts of documentary material on claimants' representatives. That may have the effect, in fact, of obfuscating the true issues or overwhelming them. And all of this is set out in Hureau by Lord Justice Singh. But equally, public authorities must not be selective in their disclosure, and they must make sure that the failure or the omission of a particular fact or document does not lead to the court being misled because of assumptions that are made about what is or is not there. So those are all the principles summarised in Hureau. How does it work in reality? Well, in Hureau, the court also emphasised a very important aspect of implementation, and that is the duty of candour is self-policing. Of course, that is the way it works. But how is it policed? It's policed, the court suggests, by solicitors and barristers. They have a particular obligation to assist the court in ensuring that these high duties have been complied with. But despite those obligations set out in the case law, there have been a series of failures over the years by UK public authorities in complying with those duties, including extremely serious ones. Some of them are mentioned in the papers, and I just want to highlight two before I come to Citizens UK. One is the case of Bancult, often known as Bancult number 4, in 2016. That led to an application based on the non-disclosure to set aside a Supreme Court judgment. And it was only just averted by a majority of their lordships. And also the case you've already heard about, Al Sweedy, in 2009, which led to an entire set of proceedings being aborted just before an adjourned hearing because it had become clear that the Secretary of State for Defence in that case could not be sure that all material matters had been disclosed. Now, the court in Al Swidi made very serious criticisms of the Secretary of State for Defence, his officials and advisors and legal advisors. And that is what led, as we've already heard, to the Treasury Solicitor's guidance. Now, that guidance is a very important document because what it does is it takes many of these principles that we've been talking about this morning and gives practical guidance on how public authorities can comply with them. And it's that practical guidance which, in the end, is likely to make the difference in individual cases between compliance with the duty of candor and non-compliance. And so, for example, that document emphasizes the ongoing nature of the duty throughout the proceedings, which includes a duty to correct mistakes or draw matters to the court's attention, which have come to light after the service of evidence. So the duty does not stop when you serve your witness statements. It does not stop when you get a judgment, and we'll see how that works in Citizens UK. It also makes clear that the role of the solicitor is not simply to inform their client about the duty of candor, but also to take active responsibility for the process of investigation and searching for relevant documents and for the disclosure process as a whole. Counsel, meanwhile, should be asked to advise on the issues in the case, so that the disclosure process can be properly targeted. Advise on those issues, not just at the start of litigation, but also all the way through. And should also be asked to advise on the nature and extent of the searches to be carried out. Now, despite the existence of all of this guidance and the Treasury Solicitor guidance, so guidance from the courts, internal guidance, there was in the case of Citizens UK, between 2017 and 2018, so very recently, a very serious breach of the duty of candor by the Secretary of State for the Home Department. It was so serious that it led to a High Court judge being materially misled in his conclusions in favor of the Secretary of State. So in that case, the High Court judge had concluded that a process that was set up by the Secretary of State in France to consider the claims of hundreds of unaccompanied minor children to join their family members in the UK was not procedurally unfair, even though those children had very little input into the process that by which their claims were refused and were given no proper reasons for refusal afterwards so that they could not correct inaccurate or erroneous or unlawful decisions. Now, he made that finding because he had been told in evidence by two senior officials from the Secretary of State that the failure to give those reasons was because of the urgency of the process and because the French should be given authorities the truth, as a series of internal emails revealed a year later, was the opposite. The French authorities had not only demanded no reasons, not only not demanded no reasons, but had repeatedly asked for reasons to be given to the children, but it was the Secretary of State who had refused to do so because she had been given legal advice that providing those reasons would stimulate legal challenges to her decisions, and she had therefore repeatedly resisted the French demands. Now, this misleading evidence, bad as it was, it gets worse because it was not corrected for over a year, despite the terms of the judgment, and was not corrected until less than three weeks before the appeal that was brought by the claimant in that case, the NGO Citizens UK, before that appeal was heard. The appeal was then allowed, perhaps not surprisingly, given what the evidence revealed, on the basis that the process set up was procedurally unfair, in particular because of the failure to give reasons. So you can see that the effect in that case of the breach of duty of candor was about as serious as it can get. It was worse than the breach in Bancoult in the Supreme Court because it led to a reversal of a judgment. Now, I've summarised the broad facts in the paper, and obviously there is more detail in the judgment, which is provides a lot of information about the misleading evidence and the emails, because the court took that very seriously, as you can imagine. But for present purposes, I want to emphasise the following matters, which are relevant to policing the duty of candour and how that works in practice. The issue on which the misleading evidence was given, the non-provision of reasons, was at the heart of the claimant's original case, and it was expressly pleaded that the Secretary of State had herself refused to give reasons despite the French having asked them to do so. So that was there from the beginning, and the Secretary of State's lawyers therefore knew. They knew that that was the issue, and what they should have done, and we still don't know exactly what happened, is ask questions about that issue, because it was a key issue in the case. If they had done so, one would have expected those emails to be disclosed. Point number two, the witness statements, which provided the misleading evidence and which rebutted the factual case of the claimant, were not accompanied by any contemporaneous supporting evidence. And this is another important issue that you see coming up in the case law, but also in Treasury Solicitor's guidance. Is there a duty in judicial review to provide witness statements or disclosure? The answer is both. But in this case, all there was witness statements. And even where the claimant in that case asked the Secretary of State to provide supporting contemporaneous documents because they were getting information on the ground that the witness statements had put a gloss on the facts that was incorrect or misleading, the Secretary of State's lawyers refused to provide it, claiming that compliance with the duty of candour required only witness evidence. So that's point number two, again leading to what ultimately happened. Point number three, the same witness statements were adduced in several sets of related proceedings with the same legal team representing the Secretary of State, also with no disclosure of contemporaneous documents. So this was a widespread breach of the duty of candour in multiple courts, in multiple proceedings. Four, the misleading evidence was only corrected after an accidental disclosure in related proceedings in the upper tribunal where the Secretary of State was represented by a different legal team. That led to requests for further disclosure of information, similar requests to those that had been repeatedly rebuffed in the Citizens UK case for the past 2 years, but on that occasion, it led ultimately to the disclosure of the emails which made all the difference to the outcome of the case. The fifth important point is, even after those emails were disclosed, and I've described the effect of them and the findings in the judgment, the Secretary of State did not accept that there had been a breach of the duty of candour. Her written submissions to the Court of Appeal claimed that the witness statements that I've referred to were, and I quote, detailed and accurate and prepared in accordance with the relevant guidelines, and that the emails were, quote, of no materiality to any of the key issues. Now, that, in my opinion, is a matter of very serious concern, because if that is the view that could be taken by lawyers, even after the emails are disclosed, what confidence can we have, can the courts have, that the searches that are being conducted under the supervision of Treasury solicitors and Treasury counsel are going to produce the relevant emails? Now, of course, this may have been, so these are submissions attempting to protect retrospectively the Secretary of State's position, but they do raise real concerns about how the self-policing duty actually works in practice. So the final sixth point I want to emphasise is that this was, and I've described it this way in the paper for good reason, a miscarriage of justice, because what actually happened is by the time that this duty of candour was corrected by disclosure, it was too late to be of any benefit to the majority of children who were entitled to those reasons. It was over 18 months after the process had concluded, and most of the children had dispersed, so they could no longer be given the reasons which the court felt they were entitled to. So these, at the start of this conference, we heard just how important the public law process is, the impact it has on individuals. But if courts are not given the right information, then the conclusions they reach may be quite the wrong ones. It is a very important, obviously, and I don't think anyone in this room disputes it, it is very important that the duty of candor is complied with, but it is also very important that those responsible for it make sure that they are policing it in the way that is suggested by Treasury Solicitor's guidance. Now, in the paper, and it's my time is up, I have suggested some potential consequences for failure to comply with the duty of candour, and in particular, the impact on trust. So this is at section 4, paragraph 18 of the paper. It is, in the end, this self-policing duty of candour and cooperation, a relationship of trust in this partnership between public authorities and the courts. If these types of breaches occur, that trust is obviously undermined. And we can see the potential impact suggested by a judge in Northern Ireland, that it may lead to less judicial restraint in ordering disclosure. But that may not be the only consequence, and some of you may be aware that in the aftermath of the second Hillsborough inquest and what emerged in those inquests about what had not been revealed in the earlier Hillsborough inquests, a bill was proposed, and it's still on the statute books. It's currently in abeyance, but it may after the Law Commission reports on its misconduct in public office inquiry, the intention is that it will be brought back for a second reading. It's the Public Authority Accountability Bill, and it has criminal penalties for non-compliance with the duty of candour. So these are important matters. They have serious consequences for individuals, but they may ultimately have serious consequences for the way in which proceedings are conducted. Thank you.